I tell you the truth, this is one of the more difficult sessions that I have had, because I'm not sure exactly what I'm supposed to be representing here beside myself. I am supposed to give you an overview of the religious significance and the religious view of the settling in Israel, and obviously to include in that how, from a religious, theological standpoint, we look at the settlements. For anyone to think that any one religious view, there is a monolithic religious view, is obviously ridiculous. There are many, many religious views here in Israel. The Haredi world, I don't know exactly how I would translate that into English. I definitely would not translate it as ultra-Orthodox. I don't know what Orthodox is, but this is ultra. For someone who's an atheist, any belief in God is ultra-Orthodox. And as we go up the scale, everything that's a little beyond what I'm doing is ultra. So I have never heard of ultra-reform or whatever, but I guess that exists also. So it depends on your perspective, what's ultra and what's not ultra. And so I don't think that's a good description of the Haredi world. Perhaps the best English description of the Haredi world would be the non-political Zionist religious world here in Israel, as opposed to the religious Zionist world, who follow different Torah scholars and different Torah leaders, or perhaps follow more political leaders than they do Torah theological leaders. The Haredi world is united in one thing, that the thrust of their opinion and their ideology is based on their rabbis and not on politicians. And on the other hand, there are many rabbis. And there are many different groups of rabbis. And there are disagreements amongst them. So you can be part of the Haredi community on one hand, and then have many diverse views on many, many subjects, including the subject of Israel, the subject of settlements, the subject of anything that has to do with religion and everything in the world, politics, social, education, ultimately has to do with religion also. So there is a vast dichotomy here, a vast variation of religious Jews and their opinions and their ideologies when it comes to what I'm going to be talking about. So who exactly I represent besides myself, I can't tell you. But what I can try to do is to be somewhat objective and to give you at least an overview of what the major ideologies are and what the differences are between them. And I think that more of what I can do is to answer your questions than to tell you an overview. But just to give you an idea of how misinformation in these areas, I saw a quote in the World Book Encyclopedia, necessarily one of the more greater source books, but it's supposed to at least be an honest, factual document. There it said that since the destruction of the temple in the year 70 CE, Second Temple, and Jews were sent into exile, and very few Jews remained in the land of Israel, there was always a group amongst the Jews known as the Zionists. And they were the ones who imagined returning to Israel someday. That is totally ridiculous. Political Zionism, and that term, didn't come about until more than 100 years ago. political secular movement, Zionism, not to catch spurs in them. That's when it existed. There were not amongst the Jewish people a group called Zionists who wanted to return to Israel from the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. But in all Jewish prayers, three times a day, all the body of the Jewish people long to return to Zion under the right conditions. And were promised by God that one day he would return us to this land. It wasn't something that a small group kept alive. It was something that was kept alive by the people of Israel, by the Jewish people. And to attribute that to a small group of Zionists who didn't even exist during this period of time is a total misinformation, total distortion of history. But that's what certainly opens the World Book Encyclopedia gets. So it's these Zionists who are causing problems today in the land of Israel, and the vast majority of Jews, except for this small group of Zionists, who always wanted to come back to Israel, have been very happy to stay wherever they were. So what I would like to do is, from a religious standpoint, talking here historical, nor am I talking political, from a purely Jewish, religious, Torah standpoint, what does this land mean to us? This is recorded in the Bible, which is holy not only to Jews, but holy to Christians also, and for a good part, what is included in the Bible is also included in the Torah. So this is not something that is extremely parochial, the facts that I'm going to tell you just from a Jewish standpoint, but a good portion, percentage of the world believes these scriptures to be holy and to be factual, and the information I'm telling you is found there. But this land was promised to our father Abraham, and later on to his son Isaac, and his son Jacob, and they lived in this land, and the places that today Jews and Muslims separate, and Christians, have the same names as those places, and we know that archaeologically wise, these are the places where they lived. This is the land that they were promised, and we spent a stint of time as slaves in Egypt, having been promised by God that one day we would be returned to this land, the land of our forefathers, and we were. After 210 years in Egypt, we were brought back by Moses and Joshua and reconquered the land that we had settled before, that we had vacated, to go down to Egypt and become slaves there, and we returned to that land of our forefathers, and we settled the land for a period of about 410 years that we had a temple here. Aside from the period of the judges and the period of the prophets, King David, King Solomon, these are people who are not only known in Jewish schools, but known worldwide. King David set up a dynasty here, and his son King Solomon built a temple, and that temple lasted for 410 years, with Jewish kings and with the Jewish people basically being sovereign in their own land. And then we believe, because of our sins, because we didn't treat this land properly, and that's not in the purpose of this talk, to analyze why we were exiled, but that's also part of the Bible. That God himself sent prophets and told us that if we don't shape up, we're going to be shipped out. And we are not going to lose our claim on this land, but we are going to have to suffer exile for a limited amount of time. And that first exile, the limited time, was set clearly, 70 years. We were to be in Babylonian exile for 70 years, and how exactly those 70 years were calculated was not clear. Until actually we came back, and then we saw how the 70 years were to be calculated. And we were in Babylonian exile. For the most part, Jews did not live in Israel during those 70 years. and eventually the Babylonians, lost control over Israel, and the Persians became the rulers here. And 70 years after we were exiled, with the permission of the Persian rulers, we were brought back. And we were given a chance to establish a second commonwealth here and build a second temple, which lasted for another 420 years. And then, because of similar circumstances that existed in the beginning, we lost our right to remain here, and we were exiled a second time. In the second exile, the prophets again, that are accepted by the Christian world and the Jewish world, and for the most part by the Muslim world also, promised us that one day we would return to this land. It's open in the Bible. Look it up. Prophet after prophet after prophet who said that yes, you would go through an exile and one day you would come back to this land. And throughout that time of exile, the Jew was allowed to come back and live in the land of Israel if he could accomplish that, and he could give the commandment of settling in the land of Israel. Not only a commandment to settle here, but tremendous benefits for anyone who lives in this land. This land is a chosen land, special land, has special qualities. And those special qualities are recognized not only by us, they're recognized by the Christian world, they're recognized by the Muslim world. This land, from the very creation of the world, was invested with very, very special qualities. And therefore, there is a command on all Jews that if they can, that they should settle in this land, and they should benefit from those tremendous spiritual benefits that one gets from living in this land. And, however, from a religious standpoint, since the time that we were exiled, we were also forbidden to take back the land of Israel by force, and to en masse leave the exile before God said that we should leave that exile. En masse. All Jews would pick themselves up and take the land of Israel. We believed that we were sent in exile for a purpose. We needed to be in a hospital outside of Israel for whatever reasons, God being that we needed to be treated outside of this land for whatever therapy we needed. And that therapy had to be in the exile that we look at as like a hospital. A hospital is not a great place to be, but if you're sick, it's a good place to be. And to leave the hospital early is also not so good. But if you're healthy enough to leave, then it's a nice thing to do. So throughout the centuries, we were prohibited from taking over this land by force. And that's why there was never an attempt by the Jewish people to amass an army and forces and take over Israel, as was done by the Christians during the Crusades or the Muslims before that. We never, whether we had the ability or didn't have the ability, we also didn't have the desire to do it. We prayed that God should return us to this land, should give us the opportunity to return to this land, but no time in Jewish history did we ever try to put that in practice by force. But the Persians gave us permission to come back and settle here, we didn't take it by force. We were given permission by the people who were basically rulers over this land at the time. And then, many Jews as could, returned here from Babylon and settled in the land of Israel. We didn't have that opportunity until about 100 years ago. Less than 100 years ago, I would imagine from the time of the Balfour Declaration, something changed in the world drastically, and that means that those who were ruling here in Israel, who had the mandate over Israel, the British, not at the time of the Balfour Declaration, right, said that they would be positively attuned to establishing a homeland for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. At the time, the British were the ones who called the shots here, and therefore it wasn't a matter of taking over this land by force against the nations of the world, against those who were here, but it was being given permission to come here and resettle our land and fulfill that command that we have, that when we have the opportunity, then we take advantage of that opportunity. And subsequent to that, the vote of the United Nations, the San Remo Conference, all fortified the Balfour Declaration, even though the English would have loved to back down from the Balfour Declaration, and in fact, for all practical purposes, limited very much. But ultimately, after the Second World War, the terrible tragedy that befell many, many people, the 6 million Jews amongst them, the world's conscience bothered it to a certain degree, and they gave us permission to have a place where Jews could call their own. And the logical place for that is the place that was promised to the Jewish people, and eventually it will be ours when God gives it back to us completely. And therefore, because the world body, the United Nations, voted that we could settle in this land, it wasn't considered taking it over by force. And what we did settle it here, with the permission of the United Nations, we had to face then armies that wanted to annihilate us and throw us into the sea. And there's no prohibition in our teachings to self-defense. And we fought a defensive war. The war of independence was not an offensive war to conquer this land. We were in this land with the rights of the United Nations. There was supposed to be a partition plan. We accepted it, and the Arabs rejected it. The Arabs made it clear that if we accept the United Nations partition plan, they will throw us in the sea. And that's exactly what they did. Or tried to. And when the state was declared, they declared war. The day of independence, fifth day of year, is not only the date that commemorates the establishment of the State of Israel, it's also the date that commemorates the beginning of the War of Independence, not the end of the War of Independence. Most people fight for independence, and the day that they get their independence, they commemorate their Day of Independence. Our Day of Independence commemorates the beginning of the War of Independence, not the end. Because we were given this land by the United Nations, and then we had to fight a defensive war to hold on to. That's not prohibited from us. Not prohibited to anybody in this world to defend their lives. At least not anyone who thinks objective. Sometimes people want to think that Jews do not have the right to defend their lives. But Jews, as well as everybody else, has the right to defend their lives. In any case, all the wars that we fought since then, and the army that we have, is called the Israel Defense Force, because basically that's what it is. It's a defense war, not an offensive army. We fought a Sinai war, and we fought a six-day war, and we fought a Yom Kippur war. And all of them basically, even if the six-day war, we produced a preemptive strike, and basically it was a defensive war. I was alive during that time, not too young, to remember the events leading up to the six-day war, where Nasser daily proclaimed that he was going to throw every Jew that lived here into the sea. And they were preparing for an annihilation, an onslaught against every person who lived here. There were no settlements there. And Israel had a right to defend itself, and they made a preemptive strike, and in that way they thwarted a war of annihilation. The Yom Kippur War, we were attacked first. We again defended ourselves, and all the wars that we fought here, basically, we didn't start the Intifada, not the first one, not the second one. So from a religious standpoint, again, it wasn't the religious leaders that called for these wars, but from a religious standpoint, these wars were not offensive wars to take over the Holy Land, but these were wars that were waged to defend the Jews who already lived here. And the right to live here was given to us by the nations of the world through the United Nations. The Haredi community, as opposed to the Zionistic, religious Zionists, there's a major difference in philosophy between how we look at this state and and how important the state as a state is. And basically, because we have a command to settle in the land of Israel, even in the time of exile, Jews who can come here as individuals can settle here and can build cities or whatever, there's no problem with that. But we don't take over the land by force. That's pretty much agreed to by all Jews throughout the century, and there have been times when more Jews were here or less Jews were here. But to have a political state was not necessarily considered by the non-Zionist religious community an intrinsic value to itself. Until the Messiah will come, and the Jewish people will be reinstated in this land by God himself, to have political autonomy, to have a political entity here, was not looked upon as an intrinsic value to itself. And therefore, when the political Zionist movement started, and they had various agendas in the beginning. One agenda was that the situation of Jews in Europe was horrendous, tremendous anti-Semitism, very, very bad economic life, and therefore they wanted to look for the possibility of moving Jews to the land and make things better for them. In the beginning, there wasn't the thought of a state necessarily, or a political entity. As political Zionism developed, it was necessary that it became an important part of their program that it's not just to be a place for Jews to settle under foreign rule, but it has to be something that we are in control of. And up until the Second World War, there was a very big argument in the Jewish community between the religious Zionists and the Haredi world, which didn't exist then, that terminology, but the non-Zionist, right? This is an aside, I consider myself a very good Zionist, but with a lowercase z, as opposed to many people I know in the United States that are very small Zionists, but with a large case z. They are political Zionists, but they don't live it. I am not a political Zionist, but I live it. So I consider myself a bigger Zionist, right, which may be not with a capital Z. In any case, but the non-political Zionist world, whether in fact pushing for a political entity here in the land of Israel was intrinsically valuable or not. That debate ended after the Second World War. Because if there wouldn't be a political entity here, then the lives of those Jews who survived Hitler would have been, again, a tremendous danger, because there was no country in this world that wanted to take in the Jews who were the survivors of the concentration camps. And they went from port to port, and the famous novels and movies made of the plight of these Jews who had nowhere to go, no country would take them in, and the only choice they had there was to return to Europe. And if they returned to Europe, it was pretty much clear what would happen to them. That their fine neighbors who took over their homes and all their property were not too happy to see them come back. And even they didn't reclaim their homes and their property. They were summarily done away with. So the Jews were either in camps in Cyprus that the British set up in order that we shouldn't upset the demographics of the pre-state of Israel, or they had no other place to go. And unless there was a Jewish state, those Jews' lives would have been in tremendous danger. And at that point, because of the situation, all religious parties, including the non-religious, secular parties, everyone agreed that it's imperative to have a Jewish state. Not necessarily from a religious standpoint, but religious people. We didn't feel that it was a religious imperative, but it was a practical imperative, because otherwise the lives of many, many Jews would have been in danger. They have no place to go. It had to be a country that was run by Jews that would accept Jews into it, refugees. And we've seen throughout the years that, whether it's Ethiopian Jews or other Jews from the Soviet Union, the fact that there is a state of Israel that will accept Jews from all over the world, and no one else will accept them under certain circumstances, where they were not accepted in times that they were accepted by the Russian Jews, were accepted by America, by other countries. But in certain situations, nobody else wants it. There has to be a country at least that Jews control where these refugees can feel safe, have a place of haven. So the question was resolved not on religious points, but more on practical points. The capture of the state was a fact. Most of the non-Zionist religious community accepted the state as a fact. The state is not an ideology, the state is a fact. What controls the state depends on democracy here. Who gets the most votes, and therefore what ideology will guide the state depends on democracy, and therefore great rabbis made the decision for their adherents that they should be involved in the state, because the only way to guarantee that the state will have the proper ideology is to work from within the system. And therefore, many great rabbis, Chazon Ish, if you've heard of him, happened to get to know who the major players were in the religious community and had tremendous impact on the entire community here and the entire world, really. These people said that there's a total imperative, there's a religious imperative to vote in elections, because that's the way that you exercise your voice and your power within a democratic state. There was a minority, we heard of them, I'm sure, that's Naturi Karpin, the really Oprah anti-Zionists, not just non-Zionists, anti-Zionists. And these are the people that you think, perhaps, right, are the ones that burn Israeli flags in America. And one of them is Arafat's foreign minister, I think, for Jewish affairs, a person named Hirsch. You know who he is, in case you hear his name again. He doesn't represent anyone. And that is not the faction I'm talking about. That is a fringe lunatic faction that every major Jewish organization or part of religious Jews, including the Naturei Karta. The Naturei Karta is a segment that is mostly represented by the Eda HaKharedis, which is the rabbinical court of the of Meishorim, and the Sakhar faction of Hasidic Jewry, who are, most of them live in Williamsburg, and many of them live here in Meishorim. Those two factions are what I'm talking about, the Torah characters. And I don't agree with them ideologically, this area, but I understand them, they're very fine people. They are not people who are lunatics. The people are different ideologies. The people you hear about, that are mostly in the press because they are lunatics, and that's what sells papers. When the man bites the dog, that's what sells the paper. Right? So that's the one we hear about the most. Are people who are Jews, who burn the Israeli flag publicly, who go to Arafat and tell him that, you know, we're on your side. These people are lunatics. Again, the establishment, all the establishments of Jewry, from the most virulent non-Zionists to the obviously the religious Zionists, repudiate these people. They nobody wants to claim them as their own. They don't listen to anyone except themselves. They don't represent anyone except themselves, and they are a very small number of fringe people who do things that obviously are from a Jewish standpoint loose. So that is not the Naturei Karta. There are a nice minority of Jews who didn't accept the state. Feel that the state is a secular state, does not represent the Jewish people, who are people because of our Torah, that's the religious standpoint, that's what we believe, and therefore they never accepted a secular state that speaks in the name of the Jewish people, that's called Israel. They don't accept money for this state, for their educational things. They don't accept money when they have children here. Everybody gets a check, they have a child. Right? National health, they tear up the check. I respect people like that. They don't accept the state, they don't accept things from the state. That's their ideology. But the vast majority of non-Zionist Jews accept the state as a state. And it's a fact. And the way to influence what happens here is by being involved in the political process. And we're the settler here, the settlement. We believe that this is our land. And we believe that the land, that the so-called settlements are on, is land that basically is for the Jewish people. On the other hand, like we say, since we are still in exile and the Messiah has not yet come, so we are, by Torah law, by religious law, we are limited in how aggressive we can be in this land. And we have to take into consideration a greater value than land or the land of Israel, and that's Jewish life. For that matter, everybody is the greatest value in this world, with certain exceptions. But there are certain things that are more important than life. Certain things that you have to give your life up for. But one of them is not settling the land of Israel. And therefore, even though ultimately, from our perspective, it's rabbis who make the final decision, but if you go to your rabbi and you ask him, should I have this operation or not, he doesn't answer you because he's a prophet. He consults with a doctor, and he finds out what all the medical information is, and after he has all of the information from those people who are involved, then he adds that Torah perspective and tells you, based on the information I have heard, this is what religiously you should do. But he doesn't just do it out of the clear sky, out of the air. He does it based on information that he gets from experts. And therefore, it's clear from the non-Zionist Haredi world, the vast majority of Torah leaders say that assembling in areas will incite hatred against Jews or endanger the lives of Jews, then that means the settling there doesn't apply. And that commandment doesn't apply, and just the opposite. You should avoid those areas. However, today things are very, very much different than they were 10 years ago or 15 years ago, whatever. Today, evacuating communities and not settling in areas, right, will make it more dangerous for other Jews or other areas. Because as the border gets closer and closer to the major population centers, the more in danger they are. And if there are outlying settlements where Jews are living already, then the border will become Tel Aviv, the border will become Jerusalem. We live in a world now where we are being attacked constantly. We're at war. And the question is, giving up land to the enemy does not make Jews more secure than less secure. And there are all different opinions, both militarily and politically. Right? There's no consensus on this. What would be safer? Give up the settlement? Not give up the settlements. Ask two people in the military, you get two different answers. Ask two people politically, you get two different answers. So therefore, the religious answer, which here depends on the political, military, economic, and a lot of other factors, which the rabbis themselves are not privy to. So they have to rely on the information given to them by experts in their field. And since the experts in the field don't agree, so there is a lot of very, very much confusion about what exactly should be done today. Should people move into settlements? Shouldn't they? Which settlements? Well, different kinds of settlements. I live in settlements. Okay, I mean, it looked like a settlement. It doesn't look like a settlement. I live in Ramat Yisrael, But the truth is, I saw the map in the American Embassy that Montesquieu was in no man's land, officially. It's not in what they call the West Bank, it's not an occupied territory, according to the American government, and it's not an Israel problem. It's in no man's land, and in fact, the Israeli Supreme Court had a decision many, many years ago that that land that you're on belongs to Israel. In any case, but right next to us is a very big city, Kiryat Sefer, of Haredi Jews, and that's has thousands of families there. And that's farther over the Green Line than we are. And when I first came to Israel, I met with Rabbi Shach, who I'm sure you've heard. Rabbi Shach was pretty much a spokesman of the Lithuanian yeshiva world, right? And he was very, very well respected, and his, what he said carried a lot of weight throughout Israel. In any case, he was, to a certain degree, against settling areas that would cause incitement against the Arab population. And the Jewish right wasn't worth settling another part of Eretz, another place to live. And he specifically was not happy with Emmanuel, Emmanuel's mention, because it was in an area that was basically populated by Arabs, and putting a Jewish settlement there, putting a Jewish city there, was not in his eyes, a positive thing. So when I first came, I spoke to him, and he asked me, why did you choose to settle? We have a certain community of people who came from America, who were given a place to develop. Was not a joke, happened to be like a kilometer over the Green Line, like I told you, in no man's land. So he asked me, why specifically there? I told him it wasn't ideological, it was specifically in the center. On purpose, there, that was the place they gave us. Here's the place that we set up there. This is the place that the Israeli government gave us. Years later, about 10 years after that, Rabbi Shach was one of the proponents of creating Kiryat Sefer, which I told you is a kilometer farther in to the Green Line. So when the people who founded Kiryat Sefer came to speak to me, I said to them, do me a favor, could you go back to Rabbi Shach, who they were very close to, and ask him why over here on purpose, on the other side of the Green Line, are you creating a community? He asked me the same question, why I said, well, same question. They told me that he laughed when he heard, and he said, now that we have such good neighbors like you, we can also be there. Meaning the problem, that it depends where you're settling. Where we settle, where we are, is not in the midst of a vast Arab population. And just the opposite. The Arabs around us, like the speaker before me said, were extremely, when I first came to Israel, the Arabs gave us our neighbors, the small villages around us, they raised olives. They gave us a barrel of olive oil for Hanukkah as a present, as a welcoming present. They worked for us, and we respected each other very much. We was an Arab who had a dispute with a few families. He had cut out holes in the walls for air conditioning. And they claimed that he didn't do his job properly, and they weren't going to pay him to pull him out, and he claimed he did do it properly. So they asked him, how do you want to solve this? Do you want to go to court? Do you want to go? What do you want to do? He said, I'll go to the rabbi of Yom Moshe. He's a religious man, I'm a religious man, and I just trust whatever he says. And he came, and I heard both sides. In the end, the Arab was right. He won the case. But he was willing to listen, and he wouldn't win the case. That's how close the relationships were. We even did some circumcisions for the Arabs around us. We wanted our mobile, our circumcision to the hell's evidence of circumcision. So they said, you're an expert, we want to have a party for that. And it was a very, very good relationship. After the first thing the father started, I used to give rides, hitches, trams, to Arabs who were looking for rides. I don't do it anymore. No one picking up. But at that time, basically our relationship was very friendly. And after the first Intifada started, one of the Arabs who I knew from the area around told me that Arabs come in from the outside forced them not to go to work, not to work for Jews or whatever, and threatened to break their legs and break their arms. And they said, we hate anybody who's a people here, not me. That's after they, even during the first intifada, the relationship was still good. Now there's no relationship. Because you don't know who's who and who's what, and there's so many stories of terror that nobody has any kind of relationship anymore. The kibbutz that was terrorized, they had a tremendous good relationship with the Arabs around them. It also it's an unfortunate situation. But basically, the non-Zionist bloc of religious Jews form their opinion as to where to settle in this land based on economic, military, political, and most important, danger to life decisions that ultimately are guided by religious leaders. So there's no monolithic, live here, don't live here, it depends on the daily situation, it depends on a vast array of factors. And then the religious leaders come to their decision based on those factors, as opposed to an ideology that says there is something intrinsically valuable of settling every inch of this country, which is true. But where we part ways is, it's true, but there are other factors that have to be taken into consideration. And some people, oh, there are no other factors, and that's it. And that's a command, an imperative, no matter what the implications and no matter what the results will be. That is not how the Haredi community looks at it. We hold the land of Israel, we cherish the land of Israel. There are people here who never stepped out of Jerusalem. We've been here for generations. They love the land of Israel. But they love the land of Israel within a context of a total religious system, it has many other factors that are important to us. This is not a one-issue religion. It's a religion that has many, many issues, and all of them have to be taken into consideration. Okay, I think that's spoken long enough. You think if there are any questions, or if you want to, yes?
Yeah, I'd like to know, how is the Jewish presence of Hebron seen?
Personally, the fact that Jews have a right to live in Hebron, I support it. Whether the Jews, at the time that the Jews went into Hebron, it was not as dangerous as it is today. Okay, they went under circumstances in the beginning, there were no political problems. Okay? Therefore, those individuals had a right to be there or not. They weren't putting their lives in any special danger when they went there. Whether they were inciting the Arabs around them, maybe. And therefore, I would imagine if they asked some of the great rabbis whether they should have done that, they would have told them not to. But once they settled there and built a community there, to evacuate those communities, now there's other circumstances that have to be taken into consideration. How much is that going to put Jewish life in danger in nearby communities? Right? Evacuating those communities. Somebody today would ask me, should I move to Hebron? I would tell them as a rabbi, no, you should not move to Hebron. If somebody from Hebron says, do I have to move away from Hebron? No, you have a family, you have a livelihood, you have a house. To move away, right, has other implications. So I don't know if I would tell any one individual, I have to hear their specific circumstances, if they have to move away from Hebron. But to move there now, for other people to go there at this point, is putting your life in danger. It's not a place to move. To evacuate the Jews who are living there, I don't think that is something that, from a Torah standpoint, would be a proper thing. So it's a very, very difficult situation. It's not to know black, nothing in this world is black and white. And the people who want to make things in this world black and white don't see the world the way it really is.
Isn't living in Yesha in any areas, doesn't that mean that you put your life into danger? Otherwise, would you disencourage people to live anywhere in the
Yesha? It depends. There are areas in Yesha that are safer and areas that are considered pretty much up to date. Driving on the highway here in Israel, if you haven't noticed, is putting yourself in an extra danger than sitting in your house. But religiously, a person is allowed to drive on the highway because even though there is a greater incidence of fatalities driving on the highway, but you have to be able to conduct a normal life forward when you can't sit in your house all the time. So there are certain risks you're allowed to take. And it really depends on how great the risks are, how important are the benefits, and you weigh one against the other, and that's what you need the rabbi to say, given all the information, what would the proper religious decision be? And therefore, there are definitely places in Yesha that are no more dangerous than living in Jerusalem or going to Chicago or any place else like that. And there are places, definitely, where on a daily basis there's constant constant danger. The places where there is constant danger or traveling on roads where there is a high incidence of terror or whatever, yeah, I would tell people that unless there's a very, very important reason why they have to travel those roads, they should. Or not live in those places. And on the other hand, there are places that are no more dangerous than any area in Jerusalem or any area in Tel Aviv, and if you take it to the absurd, right, you said the Jews shouldn't live anywhere, basically, maybe on the moon, because living anywhere in this world is not exactly these days very safe for Jews, or for that matter, anyone. Yeah. Yes.
And the previous speaker mentioned that there's been a massive movement to the right in the Haredi community in recent years, and you say that basically there's no Torah answer to the security matters, so whether to give up areas or whether to settle not, but that you have to listen to the expert, the secular experts in the field. So the question is now.
Just to correct that, I didn't say that we have to listen to the second. We have to take what the final decision is based on the information given by the secular expert.
Okay.
Or is it expert? Yeah. Still, what is it expert?
So the question is now, why, I think that's very interesting, why has the Haredi community moved to the right? Why do you now listen more to the so-called right-wing experts, not to the left-wing experts?
There's another factor here, and that is that the left has moved also, not just to the left, but they've moved to the anti-Jewish. And for no reason that I'm really familiar with, I saw that the Muslim dealt with it in one of his columns, what the reasons were, but that I am not conversant with. But for whatever reason, politically, the left here in Israel has adopted a very anti-religious, almost militant anti-religious status. And therefore, for a religious Jew to feel comfortable with the left at all, even those areas where maybe what they're saying politically, socially, or whatever, is more along the lines of what we would agree with, but since they've made this a culture come, a total war against religion, most religious people here don't feel comfortable with the political left for reasons that have nothing to do with social issues or the political issues of the left. And therefore, rabbis should feel more comfortable supporting a right-wing government which isn't in a war against them than a left-wing government that isn't a war against them. That really has nothing to do with the specific issues themselves.